Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, with you every Saturday afternoon here on News Talk 580 KMJ and online at kmjnow.com. It's going to be a fun program today with a fighter pilot who flew over 100 missions in a P-47, not to mention more than 40 more in a C-47. Not too many guys have that much experience in that pair of airplanes, but John Weiner of Sacramento, California sure does. And I want to thank Eli Setensich for letting me know about him. Many of you in the Fresno area remember Eli as a longtime journalist with the Fresno Bee, but long before that, he was a decorated pilot in the U.S. Army Air Corps in World War II. You've heard his story on this program before, and now you're going to hear from someone who's known Eli for a long time, John Weiner. And he didn't tell too many crazy stories about you, but do you have any stories you want to throw out there on Eli?
Right now, I can't think of them.
Well, I wouldn't throw him under the bus either. He's too dangerous. You two are both Cal alumni, too, having completed your education there on the GI Bill after World War II. But long before you ever knew Eli Setensich, you were growing up in San Francisco. And I've heard some interesting stories about San Francisco in December of 1941. I like to ask every veteran and start with that question about December 7th, 1941, what you remember about that day. You would have been about 19 years old at the time, I guess?
Well, I remember I used to go to the Fairmont Hotel with my swimming buddies from San Francisco Junior College. They were all there. And, of course, we went after we heard this about the attack on Pearl Harbor Sunday morning. So we all met there and talked about it. That's mostly what I remember. And, of course, everything else is history.
And San Francisco, being right on the coastline and being such an important city, there was a lot of concern that maybe the Japanese would attack there. Were you shuttering windows, turning off the lights, anything different after that news?
I don't recall doing that. I don't think we worried too much about it, being dumb kids and late teenagers. All we wanted to do was, most of us, was get in the service and go after them.
Well, that was my next question. Did you have an inkling at that moment when you heard that news that maybe this was a fight that you were going to end up joining?
Well, yeah, we were already at war, and so we wanted that even before Pearl Harbor. I was thinking of going in, wanted to get in pre-flight and learn how to fly and go in the Army Air Corps, as it was called then.
So, how did that process take place? Did you race down somewhere and sign up and get in, or how long did you wait?
Well, they had already had a program at San Francisco Junior College called Civilian Pilot Training. And up to that time, they had also been moved inland. They used to have it on the coast, but they had to go 150 miles inland. And one time they had a class at Death Valley. And the class we got into was at Reno. Once we started learning how to fly civilian airplanes, and that was 1942, early part, and it just kept going. During that period of time, I had my application in for aviation cadet training. Later on in the year, I got called up for that to go down to Santa Ana Army Air Base.
And I guess that's where you ended up meeting your friend of all these years now, Eli.
Right. We ran around in different circles at the time, but it turned out that we were destined to be together right up to this date. But we all went overseas together, graduated at the same time, and started out in troop carrier overseas. And then a few of us who wanted to get into the fighting war transferred to fighters, Eli being one of the first, and I being one of the last.
Well, and a lot happened during that transitional period. I want to ask you, I've interviewed a lot of pilots, and I've also interviewed a lot of guys who signed up for the Army Air Corps wanting to be pilots and ended up as something else because they couldn't quite make it through all the training. Was there ever a point in that process from joining the Army Air Corps to where you're actually a pilot where you thought, maybe I'm not cut out for it. Maybe I'm not going to make it. Maybe you see somebody having struggles with it, or you see a plane go down and you have second thoughts. Or were you always pretty sure that this was going to be your destiny?
I was always sure. I never had any doubts. Usually the ones that did wash out washed out for a reason. They just were not coordinated. Now, the ones that got hit by flak, because that's what we usually ran up against, that was just unlucky for them. And I felt lucky that it wasn't me, although I got hit plenty of times, but just not knocked down.
You can't fly 148 missions combined between a C-47 and a P-47 and not encounter some flak unless you're a really lucky guy. And I imagine when you went in, you probably didn't want to fly a big old boat. Probably wanted to fly something small and sleek and fast, right?
Yeah. Well, actually, when we first landed at Casablanca, December of 43, and they did... The first thing we found out is they didn't know what the hell we were doing there. Why are we there? And we were marched there were 65 of us, 35 out of Luke. And then we picked up another 35 in the Southeast Training Command on the train. Well, they finally at this camp, Marshal Leote at Casablanca, they got rid of us. And they boarded us on a train, a 48 French train, and we went across North Africa all the way to Algiers. And then when we got to Algiers, we went south about 100 miles, a place called Tilergue, which was a fighter training center. So we thought, oh boy, we're getting into fighters now. And they had P-40s and Spitfires and Hurricanes and stuff like that. Well, meanwhile, the people in charge of this Tilergue, they didn't know what to do with us either. And so they've been making inquiries in Washington or somewhere, and they said the amount that are there coincide with the amount that it never did show up at Milwaukee ATC training. And so, needless to say, they didn't send us back. So within a day or two, a whole flight of C-47s came flying in and landed and picked us all up. And that's where it all started for the next year and a half.
Now, how much training had you had in a plane that size?
None. Also, I didn't have any fighter training. Well, since this is my story, just two of us went into the 10th Troop Carrier Squadron. A fellow by the name of Charles E. Williams, he and I were bunk mates during the period that he was there. And so we started out in Naples, a little town called right at the foot of Mount Vesuvius called Pomigliano. And we flew, what we flew was litter patients that came from the front, in the 12th Air Force or 12th Army front, and flew them back to North Africa to different hospitals. So one day, well, meanwhile, in a little town on the Adriatic, in the eastern part of Italy, southeastern part, the British had been flying over Yugoslavia and dropping supplies to the partisans 1 week, to Chetniks the next week. And it all depend on which leader was in favor of the Allies at the time. So they needed help. They transferred the 10th Squadron down to Brindisi. And so we started flying night missions over Yugoslavia, Albania, northern Greece, and clear up north.
Now let me ask you, before those night missions, when you're flying these wounded soldiers back to where they can get some better treatment, was that an emotional experience for you at all? Because you had been motivated in part by the attacks on Pearl Harbor. You said you wanted to get into this and help win it. And then you are confronted with the horrors of war right in front of your face and these guys who were mutilated by whatever they went through. Was that difficult for you, or did you just kind of take it in stride?
I think I took it in stride at the time. Meanwhile, we're flying these missions during the night and sleeping in during the day, and the year is advancing. This is 1944. And it's getting warmer and warmer. And so finally, Charles Williams and me talked in our little, by our bunks. And I think I brought it up. I said, you know, we're getting pretty comfortable over here flying these missions. If we want to get into fighters, we got to do it now. So I suggested we put on our Class A's, go to the orderly room, and confront our squadron commander and formally ask him for a transfer. And that's what we did. And he said, I'll get back to you in a couple of days. And so a couple of days later, he got back to us. He says, yeah, you can transfer, but I can only transfer you one at a time, so you're going to have to toss a coin. Well, we tossed a coin, and Willie won, so he got right away. I think this was July 44. So meanwhile, I've got my transfer request in, and he came back to me, and he said, well, you can't transfer for a while without experience, but I got that covered. At the other end of the base, this is at Brindisi, is a seaport on the Adriatic. They were unloading P-47s, P-38s, and P-51s. They were all mothballed. They were cleaning them up, and they needed a pilot to fly them. So he assigned me to that squadron, and that's how I got. I checked myself out. I had a crew chief standing on the wing in the P-47 and the P-38. There was one other flight officer that was he crashed the 47 and the 51. And so the only one he hadn't crashed was the 38. So that's the only thing. Any 38s were there, I didn't get to fly because he flew it. So that's what I did clear into September.
Had you ever flown any of those fighters before?
No. First time was there. That's about that part of the story.
Now, I want to ask you about the C-47s, but we need to take our first commercial break, so we'll get into some of those night missions. How dangerous were they, and why did he earn a presidential unit citation? We'll get those answers from John Weiner, 88 years old, of Sacramento, California, when Hometown Heroes continues next on News Talk 580 KMJ.
This is Hometown Heroes. Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. My guest today, 88-year-old John Weiner of Sacramento, California. By the time the program's over, we're going to hear why he earned a couple Distinguished Flying Crosses in his career at the Army Air Corps in World War II. He kept flying long after that. Maybe we'll talk to him about that as well. Before we left off, he told us how he was transferred from a squadron flying transport missions to a fighter group. But I want to ask a little bit more, get some more detail about these early missions. If you flew 44 missions in a C-47, some of them had to be eventful. And I understand that at some point during that, your group earned a presidential unit citation. Why was that?
Well, just helping the war effort, I guess, helping the British carry those supplies over. I mean, it was almost any kind of weather. We didn't have we carried a navigator on board, but it was all up to him. We didn't have radio navigation like they do now. It was also the drop system. As I recall, they had three different identification. The Nazis were there, Germans, and these two groups, Chetniks and Partisans, were always against each other. And so a lot of times they'd have a marker on the ground, fires shaped like a cross or zero. Then they'd had to have two other things. One was a code of the day, Morse code with a light, and the other was a color of the day. And that was also with a colored light. And unless they had all three, we wouldn't drop. And very seldom were we wrong, because very seldom did all three of them have all the right colors, the right code, and the right shape fires. A couple of times we flew daytime over those Yugoslavian mountains, and we couldn't believe that's what we'd been flying every night over, because we couldn't see them. And usually these, these bonfires, drop points, were on a hilltop, but sometimes they were in a valley. And so to get down to them, we'd have to circle these fires in a tight circle and then just lose altitude and get lower and lower, and then realizing that we had mountains on either side of us. And so generally the dangers of flying that were most harrowing. Although we did get one C-47 while I was there, shot down with his crew by a German night fighter. One guy bailed out. I'll never figure this out. It was a co-pilot. And he had to clamber over all these other people that were in the airplane, because he had a pilot, co-pilot, he had a navigator, and a radio man, four of them up front. And he had two or three GIs in the back throwing the stuff out. And he made it out. So, it was dangerous. And there wasn't much glamour to it. But we still spent, I spent 300 hours in my 44 missions over enemy territory.
Well, and you talk about the one C-47 getting shot down. If you do encounter enemy aircraft, there's not a whole heck of a lot that you can do about it. It's not like you're very heavily armed in a C-47.
That's right. Unarmored C-47.
And any kind of escort at all?
No. We made, as I mentioned earlier, a couple missions where we go during the day, and they clear a small strip. We land, and then we pick up escaped PWs, most of them wounded, and fly out. And then when we did that, we had a P-51 outfit, I think black fighter pilots from the 15th Air Force escort us.
The Tuskegee Airmen, the Red-Tailed Angels, I guess they call them. So you had 44 missions there. You tried to get out sooner. You lost the coin flip, so I had to stick around for 44. But just to spell it out for our listeners, why did you want to get out of those kind of duties and get into a fighter?
Well, this sounds corny, but I just wanted to get into the shooting war. You know, I felt defenseless in the C-47, although it was comfortable duty, and that was the only mishap. Well, we lost a couple airplanes to weather, bad weather, and I remember one guy I flew with as co-pilot. He'd just gotten a Dear John letter. And he was suicidal, and he was command pilot, and he worried me a little bit. But other than that, it was not too bad a duty. But I still wanted to get in the shooting war, and I knew that if we hadn't made that coin toss earlier on, that I'd have got comfortable and it wouldn't have done it. And as I mentioned earlier, there's only about six of us that ever did go into fighters out of 35. All the rest of them stayed in and flew their missions. A lot of them went to England, flew on D-Day, pulled gliders or dropped paratroopers. And one of the interesting things while I was in the C-47s is I got detached with a crew back down to Sicily. And our job then was to practice dropping paratroopers and pulling gliders. Little do we know that they had planned an invasion for later on in the year.
So you practiced for D-Day. You just weren't there on June 6th.
Right. I was still in June of, I was still in troop care on D-Day.
When you finally did get transferred and you end up in this 86th Fighter Group flying P-47s, how were you received by those guys? Because I imagine a lot of those pilots were guys who had been flying P-47s for a while, and here you come as the young blood who's trying to do what they're doing.
Well, they had a mission goal that when they reached it, they went home or either got shot down. Or when I finally did get, which was September of 44, I think the goal, the mission going home amount was 100. And so I started flying. One interesting thing, though, when I finally got transferred and my orders came through when I left for NDC, we thought that the 86th Fighter Group was in Corsica. And our route from Brindisi was to Rome. We landed at Rome. I was on my own, I just with my gear. And I signed in, some USO thing, and started taking in the town. And I went to headquarters and asked them where the 86 was, and they didn't know. So I said, well, I'm not going to worry about it. So I looked up the nearest nightclub and went to it. And I'll be damned if I didn't run into Eli and Jim Sturman and a third guy whose name I don't remember.
So just randomly, you run into your old buddies that you knew way back from Santa Ana in training. You run into them in Rome because you couldn't find who you were looking for.
Right. I ran into them. And then they had a room in a apartment that with the different flights in the squadron switched off on. And this was their week. And they were at this place called Broadway Bills. So I spent the next day or two with them. And so they had to go back. And Eli or somebody, Jim Sturman, said, well, we can't take you and your gear. We'll take your gear and leave it off there when we go back. And they happened to be on the mainland in Grosseto, Italy. They weren't even in Corsica. So within the same day or a few hours, I went to the transportation office of 12th Air Force and got a weapons carrier and a driver, and some nurse was going up there. And there was a hospital, I forget where, could have been Pisa, north of Grosseto. And so that's where we went. And that's how I got there. Oh, so in answer to your question, which you won't believe this, I remember what it was. When I first got in there, the first thing you do is go to the officers' club and meet all your potential buddies. Meanwhile, between the time I drove up there, Jim Sturman had gone on a mission and got shot down. And there was one of our old friends, our leader, in fact, from the States all the way over there, was Jackson Saunders. He got shot down within a few days just prior to me getting there. And somebody else. So I wrote in my book, I said, I wanted to get into fighters, but this is too much. Because all these guys that I was looking forward to seeing, the only one that wasn't shot down was Eli.
So you're starting to have second thoughts, maybe?
Well, yeah, momentarily. And after that, things went on pretty smoothly, and I started flying missions.
And we've got 104 of those to talk about. I don't know if we can fit in 104, but we'll hit some highlights. And I want to ask you one more thing that I did thumb through what you've written down for your children and grandchildren, and I commend you for doing that. I hope a lot more veterans, if they never get on this program or talk about it anywhere else, that they'll try to write down their memories for future generations to know about. One thing that you mention in here is that you got to meet one of the greatest athletes of all time, who himself was a World War II veteran, who's buried in Arlington National Cemetery, Joe Louis. How did you guys end up meeting the great boxing champ?
Oh, well, we were back in Brindisi in troop carrier, and I was waiting for these orders to come through, and they finally, that particular day when Joe Louis was there and he met all of us, not just me, but the rest of the people in the squadron. There's three things. That was one of them. And I pointed out in my book, I said the other one was I got my transfer. And all. And yeah, he was a great man, and he gave a little speech. I don't remember what it was, but I guess he was with the USO troop and just traveling to back and forth to the different air bases.
And you're just a 21, 22-year-old kid at this time. I imagine you knew full well who Joe Louis was. You'd either read about him in the newspaper or listened on the radio when he fought the great Max Schmeling, or you probably had some impression of who this guy was. It was probably a big deal to you, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I listened to all his fights when I was a kid. We lived down in south of San Francisco in a place, San Carlos, and we listened to his fights with Braddock and Max Baer, and he was just a great champion, and he was a hero in our eyes.
Well, some neat memories. We need to take another commercial break, but when we come back, we'll get into the Thunderbolt, the P-47, the Jug, as some people affectionately or not so affectionately have nicknamed that airplane over the years. We'll get John Weiner's take on it. He should know. He flew 104 missions in it. We'll be right back with more of Hometown Heroes. This is News Talk 580 KMJ.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. We continue now with 88-year-old World War II veteran John Weiner. He flew P-47s, more than 100 missions in World War II. Now, 104 missions in a P-47, how many different airplanes do you think that was? Because I'm sure you didn't have the same one carry you for all 104.
Well, darn near. Yeah. Yeah. I had this one airplane. They loaned it out to another squadron, another flight. And that guy got hit by 88 and just blew that plane, just wrecked the airplane. And it teed me off, although I got his replacement. It was D-28. And then we got a more modern one, D-30. So...
And when you were flying these C-47 transport planes, you probably didn't have a whole lot of nose art on those. But when you've got a P-47... either someone's decorated it for you or you get the honor of decorating it yourself. Did you ever have that chance to name or decorate the nose of one of your jugs?
Yeah, I had the chance. I never could think of a name. I remember Eli named his As You Is or As You Ain't. But I could never think of a name, so I just never did do it.
So there was nothing painted on the side of your airplane other than maybe your name?
Well, it wasn't even that. I didn't have much imagination then.
Decorated by bullet holes, huh?
Yeah, plenty of them.
Well, tell me about that. When you talked about wanting to get into the shooting war, and then you realize that means they're shooting at you too when some of your buddies get shot down. Do you remember the first time that you really got hit pretty bad and how you reacted to that?
Well, you know, I never got hit real bad. I got hit quite a few times, holes in different parts of the airplane, but not like some of them. Well, like, for instance, Eli's, like, I got to tell you, his. He was on a mission, and he got hit. So he turned the magneto switch off to kill the engine. And he was gliding, and he saw a hedgerow of trees right where he was going to hit him. So he turned the switch back on, the engine caught, and he flew home. Well, meanwhile, back at the base in Tontonville, France, we had been grounded, and I was flight leader, had been slated to make the next mission up, and we just sat around the ready room all day long, waiting for the weather to clear. So we heard that two airplanes were coming in, and we could see them low, low, low. And so we walked up. Our operations officer was a tent. And so we walked up towards the runway, and the runway was 75 feet lower on one end than the other. And Eli was coming in, and he had a Burt Bonnier on his wing, this other airplane. And he came by, just a few feet from us, going up the runway, and his tail wheel was not down. He didn't have a canopy on, and his fuselage was all black with oil. And that old jug got him home anyhow. I mean, it was just a single-engine airplane, but it had 18 cylinders, and it would run with two of them or three knocked out, and a magneto. So that was Eli's deal.
Well, and that's what I've heard from so many guys who flew that airplane, and you hear the debate over and over again, a P-51 versus a P-47, and what the P-47 guys always say is it was a lot more durable, could take a lot more pounding. It sounds like you experienced that too.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, the main difference was the fact that it was P-47 was an air-cooled Pratt & Whitney R2800 engine with 18 cylinders, whereas the P-51, which is the thing that's glamorized by the Hollywood media, was liquid-cooled, and all it took was a little hole to let some of that liquid out of the air-cooled system, and the engine would freeze up. And that was the end of it. But the jug was not that way.
Well, now you're going to get some of the P-51 guys after me after they heard you say that. Let me read something here. Now, you have taken down a lot of your information to preserve it for your children, and one of the things that I saw in the little book you put together was a citation for the Distinguished Flying Cross. And here's how it reads. For John C. Weiner, 1st Lieutenant Air Corps, 86th Fighter Group, by direction of the President. For extraordinary achievement while participating in aerial flight as a pilot of a P-47 type aircraft, on 10 January 1945, Lieutenant Weiner led an 8-plane formation of fighter bombers in an attack upon an enemy oil storage depot at Milan, Italy. Displaying great courage and superior flying ability as he skillfully maneuvered through a heavy overcast over heavily defended enemy territory upon the approach to the target, Lieutenant Weiner's perfect run over the objective enabled his P-47s to score direct hits, inflicting great destruction and damage upon this vital military installation. Continuing his attack in the face of heavy enemy ground fire, Lieutenant Weiner repeatedly strafed other targets in the area, destroying or damaging one locomotive, more than 30 freight cars, and large quantities of military supplies. On more than 85 combat missions, his outstanding proficiency and steadfast devotion to duty have reflected great credit upon himself and the armed forces of the United States. Signed by John K. Cannon, Major General. Now, when you hear that, does that sound like what you remember about January 10th, 1945?
It's amplified a little bit. I remember the mission, yeah.
And I'm sure you took out as much as they said you took out, and it talks about heavy enemy ground fire. How do you stay focused on what you're shooting at when you see everything flying up at you?
Just concentrate. You had to concentrate. That was your mission. So concentration, I guess.
And that was the first time that you received the Distinguished Flying Cross. I'm sure you'd seen other pilots receive that, had them pinned on them, whatever. You knew that this was a pretty prestigious honor, that maybe it could help you get home sooner. Did that mean something to you at the time, to receive that?
No, not really. I remember they had a awards ceremony in our bar, and we were stationed at Pisa, Italy. And some general showed up to pin the medal on us, but that's all I remember.
Fair enough. Well, we're at that point. We need to take one more break, but when we come back, we'll try to get some more out of John Weiner. He's got plenty of stories to tell with 104 missions in P-47s, nearly 150 combined between fighters and transports. We'll be right back with the rest of Hometown Heroes here on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Now, more Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. As usual, the time goes by way too fast. I probably didn't feel that way in World War II for John Wiener. Incidentally, the war in Europe ended on his 23rd birthday, May 8th, 1945. So that was a pretty special birthday for him. Another date that he remembers is April 20th of 1945. That's someone else's birthday. You remember whose birthday that is, April 20th?
I found out since. Hitler.
Exactly. So it's fitting what you and your fellow pilots of the 86th Fighter Group did that day. Here's the citation for a Distinguished Flying Cross on a mission that also earned them the Presidential Unit Citation. On April 20th, 1945, Lieutenant Wiener, leading a formation of fighter bombers, distinguished himself by outstanding aggressiveness and courage in attacks upon enemy airfields. In the face of intense ground fire, he skillfully dive-bombed and destroyed two hangars on one airfield, strafing and setting fire to four aircraft on another. Disregarding intense anti-aircraft fire, he led his flight in repeated low-level strafing attacks upon a third airfield, destroying additional aircraft. His exceptional airmanship and steadfast devotion to duty reflect great credit upon himself and the Army Air Forces. He entered military service from California, of course, and that's signed by command of Major General Wieland. So April 20th, 1945, that makes you sound pretty courageous. You're probably just trying to make it home from that mission, huh?
I think it was exaggerated by our interrogation officers.
You guys all tell me that. I don't always buy that exaggeration line. But go ahead. Tell me what happened from your eyes.
Well, all I remember is one airfield. And I remember that it was not hot like the other airfields. And so we kind of had a field day shooting up those airplanes. But the other six that were still flying at altitude, I only took four down, or three with me, four airplanes.
So you started out with 10 airplanes, but you left the formation with three others.
And they're still there, but they're circling, and they're getting impatient. And they're hollering at me, says, well, let us come down. And I said, the air traffic was more dangerous than the flak, which it turned out to be there was no flak. Well, there was flak, but I found out that if you stayed below a certain level, which was on the ground, low to the ground, the flak all went over your head. And it turned out that the flak guns were on the other side of a obstruction, like a hangar. And so if we were close to the runway, they could shoot at us, but they couldn't hit us. And so I remember that I finally relented and told us, let the other guys come down. And the first thing I know, I'm head to head with another P-47. I'm going one way on a runway, and he's coming the other way. Right on the mid-collision, I was already low to the ground. I figured instinctively he'd pull up. And sure enough, he did. So I pushed down and made it, maybe just inches off the runway and went under him. But we crossed, sure enough, one like the other. And that was where the real danger was, as it turned out. We didn't know you weren't going to be shot at, but it was just one of those things. It's like going duck hunting, and you get your limit.
I'm curious, have you ever thought, in the years since then, well, what if he was thinking the same thing? What if he was expecting me to pull up, and he went down?
Well, then it would have been a mid-air collision. And I just gambled. It's, you know, how much time you got to think of in a situation like that. And, of course, I'd already been there for over a year and been doing all this, and so I had a little more experience than most anybody in my flight. So I made the right move, lucky for me.
And I'm sure when you all got back to your base after that mission that there was some conversation about that near miss on the above the runway.
That I don't remember. In fact, he may not even have known it. Yeah, he was coming down the runway, and I saw him, but I don't know if he saw me or not.
So you didn't go harass him afterwards. You were just satisfied to still be walking around.
I don't even know who it was. It is just another airplane. Big P-47, 14,000 pounds, going about 200 miles an hour.
Not the kind of game of chicken that I would want to play.
No, that's right. Anyhow, I survived that one.
Well, you survived all of them. And I imagine that occurred to you once you got to come home, that you had survived quite a bit. Do you remember what it felt like to finally be done with all those missions and to be heading back to the United States?
Well, I don't know. I got used to doing it. I kind of missed it.
You didn't want to come home?
No. In fact, we had a group colonel, George T. Lee, and when the war ended, he tried to get the 86th Fighter Group sent lock, stock, and barrel to China, Burma, India. And so we were off of that. I was.
You were ready to go fly some more missions and strafe some more targets.
Yeah, I wasn't married, and I enjoyed what I was doing. Unfortunately, there were guys like me.
Did you have any special memories of your 23rd birthday, May 8th, 45? Did you hear that day that things were over, or had you kind of felt that for a while?
I was in London at that time on a leave. Everybody was celebrating at, right by Trafalgar Square. Yeah, that's where I was. I wasn't at the outfit flying.
So you thought they were just having a big party for you, huh?
No, we knew the war was over. They were talking about, but it had May 8th didn't arrive until I'd been in London a couple, 3 days.
Now, you say you didn't want to stop flying, and you didn't stop flying. You ended up flying for years after World War II. You stuck around long enough to, you had flown against some German jets, I guess, but now you got to fly American jets eventually. What did you get out of that, of staying in the Air Guard and continuing to fly and get a taste for all these new airplanes?
Oh, well, I always did stay in the reserve when I got home and went back to school. But I stayed in the reserve, and so a year or two went by, and pretty soon they start coming out with jets, and Hamilton Air Force Base had the first F-84s there, and our reserve meeting ground was at Hamilton Air Force Base. So I put in to fly those, and I was accepted, checked out, checked myself out. They didn't come out with a two-seated jet till after, a few months after. So I thought this was so great. Then when I graduated from Cal, I put in for active duty. And I got recalled, and this was during 1950. So later in the year, even after I got recalled, we went to war with North Korea. Although I was in during the Korean War, I didn't go over to Korea. I had enough points from my missions and medals and stuff like that from World War II. They didn't even ask me.
And by this time, you were married, so you probably had a little different perspective on that.
Right. Yeah, I went back to Cal, met my wife there. We proceeded to build a family.
Well, and you don't strike me as an overly sentimental kind of guy, but has it ever occurred to you when you think about your wife or your three children or your grandchildren, that those children never would have been born if you didn't survive 148 missions in the air in World War II?
Well, no, but you're making me think that.
It is true, isn't it?
I suppose it is.
When you look back on World War II and you think about the guys that you served with, those who did come home and those who didn't come home, and you run into someone today who wasn't alive then, who doesn't understand what it was all about, what do you tell them? What do you tell them about why you guys did what you did and why it's important for us to remember it today?
I guess we don't talk about it much. They don't understand. And so what's the point? That's all I can say.
You kind of wish people did understand?
Well, once in a while, I'll wear my hat, which I got a whole bunch of stuff on from World War II. Somebody will stop me, want to shake my hand. And that is always kind of neat. Other than that, I just like Eli and the rest of them, we just have to live with our memories.
You proud of what you did?
Oh, yeah. And the people I met, lost a lot of good friends, like Willie. He was the first one when we were back in Trip Carrier. But he didn't make it past December of 44. He got in northern Italy up by Verona. He got hit by flak, shot down, and never found his body. A lot of the others that did go down, Eli and I remember we went with a German-speaking NCO, and a jeep went out looking for Cuppers. He was a guy in another flight. I was on his mission when he got direct hit on an airfield, and I remember the flash, but I just thought it was a AK-AK gun. And it was his airplane blowing up. And he went right straight in to the runway. So anyhow, we went back to where we thought it was and found his wreckage, his grave. And in my book, I've got the ones that we did find, pictures of the graveyards that they still have and maintain in Germany and France and Italy.
I'll put some of that information online at kmjnow.com. I got to ask you, when you think about that, the guys that you just mentioned, and when you reflect on what you witnessed, did you ever think that could have been me? That just as soon it could have been my plane that went in, or me that got shot down or killed?
No, I never did think that. And I've heard that there's a story that goes around where 10 guys were offered GI insurance for $10,000 back then, and none of them took it because none of them thought they were going to get killed, and they were all slated for combat.
And that's the way you felt?
Yeah, that's the way I felt.
Well, is there anything that I haven't asked you about that you think is important for us to understand about what you did in World War II, why you served your country?
Oh, no, it's just another incident. We had a method of bailing out, and we didn't have seat ejections then. And our method was you throw all your straps off and radio gear, crank full nose down trim, and just throw the stick forward. After you get rid of the canopy, of course, you got to remember all those things. You go flying out of the airplane. Well, anyhow, I was on this guy's flight, and flying his number 3 man, and he got hit. We were attacking a German ammo train, and there was a lot of flak guns around. He got hit. And we're right over the Rhine River, and stationed in France. And so I want to see this. So I get right on his wing, and I stayed back so I wouldn't distract him. He jettisons his canopy and throws everything off, and pops the stick after giving full down trim, and he comes flying out of that airplane, and he misses the tail by a good 6 feet, and then he just starts falling. And of course, it's the immense size of the ground that you're looking at from about 5,000 feet, and he gets smaller and smaller and smaller and disappears. And we think he's going to hit the ground. Well, the chute finally opens, and he's still 1,000 feet, 1,500 feet up, right on the Rhine, and which happened to be the bomb line at the time. And so the wind goes which way, and he lands on a little spit of island. So then I pay attention to his airplane, and it's flying around without a pilot, and finally crashes, and there's no smoke coming out of it or anything. He probably could have flew that back, just like Eli flew his back. And so I got a wingman on me. And so we circle around and go back before he touches the ground in his parachute. And just about that time, he does touch the ground, and there's a French peasant comes out to help him bundle up his chute. They walk off, and we're just flying over, and I hear a room. And it turns out that the Germans across the way, across the bomb line, across the Rhine River, had lobbed a mortar. And it came almost got two airplanes and those two guys. And then we flew home. And that's the only story I wanted to tell.
So did he get hit by that mortar, or he dodged it?
Oh, yeah, he didn't get hit. He came back that afternoon within 2 or 3 hours.
Pretty fortunate guy.
Yeah, yeah. Well, then, within a week, he got shot down again.
I spoke too soon.
Yeah, but then he came back after the war. He was in a German hospital. And first indication he got that the war was over, that all the employees, doctors, nurses, evacuated. They all disappeared, left the patients in their bed. And so he walked home from there.
Sounds like quite the character, and I'm speaking to one, too. One more question that occurs to me. I think I know the answer to it, but I'll ask you one more question. You miss flying?
Well, I did for a long time, and when I get to the age now, I don't even think about it.
Well, I'm glad you were able to relive some of that with us today. Thank you for sharing your stories, and thank you for serving our country.
Thank you for interviewing me.
Well, it's been my privilege and pleasure, and thanks again to Eli Setensich for letting me know about his old buddy, John Weiner. If you want to see what those two looked like back in the 1940s, go to our website, kmjnow.com, and check out some of those pictures, or go to the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. That's our program for today. Thanks for listening on News Talk 580 KMJ.